You may be seated. Thank you for bringing the lights up. And I want to invite you to turn to 1 Corinthians chapter 3, which is where we're picking up from a couple of weeks ago. 1 Corinthians chapter 3, if you don't have a Bible of your own, there's a red pew Bible under the seat in front of you. And 1 Corinthians chapter 3 is found on page 167 in the back half of the book. Page 167, we were away for a week. I hope you had a good 4th of July holiday celebration with family or friends. And we're back now to the task of pretty much coming back to the same problem that occupies Paul's attention for the first four chapters of 1 Corinthians. It's that problem of the favoritism, the personality cults, the power struggles, the boasting, the worldly wisdom, all that that is shaping a community that Paul had founded just 3 or 4 years previous in Corinth to be divided as different leaders rally around different leaders' names in order to bring people to their side, to their group. And in doing that, the church is divided and fractured. We spent a lot of time with Paul wrestling with that issue, and in chapter 2 of 2 weeks ago, we had Paul speaking about how this is not the wisdom of God, this favoritism, these power struggles and personality cults and boasting. Instead, he wants to talk of an eternal wisdom, God's wisdom, and he instructs them that that wisdom comes through the Holy Spirit, that the Spirit is the means through which we enter into the wisdom of God. And that's how chapter 2 ended, and we just touched the first part of chapter 3 last week. Because Paul pulls the rugs out from under his listeners. He tells them, you need the Spirit so that you can know God's wisdom. But dear Corinthians, you're not spiritual. You're just babes. You may remember this from 2 weeks ago. You may not. But this is where he pulls the rug out from underneath them. Chapter 3, verse 1. And so, brothers and sisters, I could not speak to you as spiritual people, but rather as people of the flesh, as infants or babes in Christ. I fed you with milk, not solid food, for you were not ready for solid food. And even now you are still not ready, for you are still of the flesh. How do I know that? For as long as there is jealousy and quarreling among you, are you not of the flesh and behaving according to human wisdom or inclinations? For when one says, I belong to Paul, and another, I belong to Apollos, aren't you just acting like mere humans? Not people anointed by the Spirit of God, not people engaged in the wisdom of God, but instead working according to Corinthian wisdom, the wisdom of the world, the wisdom of personality cults, power struggles and boastings, and other such things. So he's pulled the rug out from underneath them. And once he's done that, he now wants to spend the rest of the chapter doing something that will be very helpful for you and me. He's going to tell us what real Christian ministry should look like, what service in the church of God should be like. And he starts it off in verse 5 by saying, you know, what then is Apollos? What is Paul? Servants through whom you came to believe. So that key word of servants is going to be incredibly important to all the discussion that's about to come. That Paul, Apollos, Cephas, all these different leaders that they're rallying around, they're not masters, they're servants. They are not the ones that own the field or the building or the temple. They are the ones serving in that. And in doing that, they're meant to work and to serve together in harmony, not at odds with each other. So he's going to talk about this service, and he's going to use 3 metaphors to speak about how this service works out in real life. He's going to talk about the servants working God's field. He's going to make the servants field hands, laborers in a farm. And then he's going to talk about the servants building Christ, building on the foundation of Christ. And then he's going to move to how the servants are meant to sanctify God's temple. They're to keep God's temple holy. So you can see the 3 metaphors, they're bolded. We're talking about a field, we're talking about a building, we're talking about a temple. All of those are Paul's way, metaphorically, to speak of the church. That the church is God's field, the church is God's building, the church is God's temple. So what should Apollos and Cephas and Paul and any other person that claims to be a minister of God be known as? What should they be doing? And that's what this whole chapter is about. Verse 5 again. What then is Apollos? What is Paul? Servants, through whom you came to believe as the Lord assigned to each. I planted, Apollos watered, but God gave the growth. So neither the one who plants nor the one who waters is anything, but only God who gives the growth. The one who plants and the one who waters have a common purpose, and each will receive wages according to the labor of each. For we are God's servants working together. You are God's field, God's building. Very wonderful passage about servanthood and what it means to serve in the Lord's vineyard or in the Lord's field. And what you immediately learn is the ministers, the servants, Apollos, Cephas, Paul, all of those, none of them are masters. None of them are meant to lord it over others or to be in competition with one another because they're working in the same field. They're not masters, they are servants, and they don't even own the field. They're servants. The field is owned by God. Verse 9 makes that clear. You are God's field, God's building. These servants, however, have various tasks, and they're different tasks. And you see that in verse 6. Paul says, I planted this church in Corinth, but Apollos came along after me and he watered. He had a different task. And when he watered, he caused growth to happen, but it wasn't even Apollos that caused the growth, verse 6b, but God gave the growth. So neither the one who plants, Paul, nor the one who waters, Apollos, is anything, but only God who gives the growth. They have different tasks, both are necessary. Without a planter, there's no crops to water. Without someone watering it, the crops will die. Both are serving a similar common purpose, and yet both Paul and Apollos and Cephas and all the rest, including me, are unable to in any way make growth happen. If growth is going to occur, it's going to occur because God uses their works, uses their efforts, and brings growth through them. But it's not their hands that have made the growth. They've just been instruments, just like, you know, a farmer doesn't make a plant grow. They just tend to things so that there will be growth happening. So Paul wants the people there to see very clearly any success belongs only to God. And when you come to brass tacks, Paul, Apollos, Cephas, the best speaker, the best minister, the best servant, all of them are serving a common purpose. All of them are working together. And you have a beautiful phrase in verse 9, synergē, from which we get the word synergism, which is to work together. And it's verse 9, we are God's servants, synergē. We're working together. Working together with who? Working together with God, which is a high honor, but working together with one another, which is what is field building all about. It is about them working together, sharing a common purpose. I love this paragraph for one reason. It gives a perfect balance about how we should look at anyone who's ministering in God's field. If we think too much of someone who's ministering, well, they're just a servant. If we think too little of them, they're co-workers with God. You have that perfect balance. You can't think too highly of them because they can't make anything grow. They're just the field hands. But if you think too lowly, you're missing out on the fact that they're co-workers with God. God is using them as instruments to make the growth occur. Their work is indispensable for the growth. They are important, but not necessary. They are servants tending God's field. So what are they to do in that service, in that working of God's field? And here's where Paul wants to shift his metaphor to a building. Because he can only do so much with this farm metaphor. He now wants to talk about building on a foundation. And this again has wonderful insights on Christian leadership. Verse 10, according to the grace of God given to me, like a skilled master builder, I laid a foundation. Paul planted the church in Corinth. And someone else is building on it. Each builder must choose with care how to build on it. Paul says, you know, I founded this church, but I'm not the foundation. Instead, here's the foundation, verse 11. For no one can lay any foundation other than the one that's been laid. That foundation is Jesus Christ. He's told us that again and again in the opening chapters. I determined to preach nothing among you except Christ and Him crucified. But we preach Christ. Paul is all about making sure that the foundation is Christ. And even though he's the founder of the church, he's not the foundation. What matters is not the preacher. What matters is the one preached. And the one preached is not Apollos or Cephas or Paul. The one preached, the one that is the foundation for the entire structure that Paul and Apollos and Cephas are all building on, is Jesus the Christ. And so now he wants to talk about how we build on that foundation. And this is a wonderful verse, verse 12. Now, if anyone builds on the foundation with gold or silver or precious stones or wood or hay or straw, the work of each builder will become visible, for the day will disclose it, because it will be revealed with fire, and the fire will test what sort of work has been done. Now, come back to verse 12. You see those six materials? Gold, silver, precious stones, wood, hay, straw. Why do you think Paul picks these six building materials to build on top of the foundation? What is it about these things that he's trying to highlight? There's a couple of answers you could give. Any thoughts?
Some of those elements can be destroyed.
All right. And namely, in a way that the next verse very much hints at, they're combustible. Wood, hay, and straw can go up in flames. Gold, silver, and precious jewels will withstand the flames. There's one other thing, and I think that's the bigger issue that Madeline already hits on here.
Is it also because it covers everything that any class, any kind of financial status has to do with building? The wealth you can build with gold and precious metals?
That is an interesting thought that no commentator comes up with, but that's an interesting thought, particularly when you go all the way back to that, consider your calling, not many were noble, not many were mighty. Because nobody goes in that direction, but that's an interesting direction, because instead of seeing half as combustible and half as lasting, you're now seeing that, you know, what people are contributing, everything from the lowest hay, straw, all the way to gold and silver, is a valuable contribution. I can't go in that direction, as rich as that possibility is, because no one ever says that, and I've never thought about that till just now, Chris. Wow. Bravo, man. You've said something that none of the commentators say. There's another one. I can't go anywhere with that, but that's really provocative. Yeah.
I think he's talking about the quality of the teachings.
You see a different quality for these, or at least it's almost in a descending order of value. Gold, silver, precious stones, you know, you're starting at the top. Gold, silver, precious stones. And then you're going to lesser quality, lesser valuable supplies, wood, hay, and straw. Most commentators go the route that Madeline is suggesting, that the second half of these materials are all combustible. And the reason they do, you can see why when you look at verse 13, the work of each builder will become visible, for the day, and that is the day of judgment when the Lord evaluates, will disclose it, because it will be revealed with fire, and the fire will test what sort of work each has done. And so many connect that to, okay, the fire will burn the wood and hay and the straw, the fire won't burn the gold, hay, and silver. Whatever Paul's doing here, he's certainly saying you have to think carefully about what you're building on the foundation, and make sure you're putting some thought into it, because how you build on it is going to be evaluated by the construction chief, who in this case is God. The Corinthians knew of buildings and they knew of construction, and they knew that people would come along who were construction managers and say, hey, that's not up to code. And they'd fine them, or they'd say, that's a bad material, and they'd go for another builder altogether. So they were quite aware, just as we are, of construction and of workers and of construction managers who'd come along and evaluate and write things up or say, you got to start from scratch. And here Paul wants to say, the one who's going to evaluate the work that Paul and Apollos and Cephas and Rich and everyone else does is going to be God. So take care for how you build on this foundation. Verse 14, if what has been built on the foundation survives, the builder will receive a reward. But if the work is burned up, the builder will suffer loss. The builder will be saved, but only as through fire. This is Paul's serious words about ministry, and saying to those who claim the mantle of Christian leadership, be very careful how you build on the foundation. There are bad things weak things, things that aren't valuable enough, things that aren't appropriate that you might build on this foundation. And then there are precious things that you might build on it. Some will stand the test, others won't. And you need to be thinking about how you're building on this foundation. For Paul's audience, he's clearly trying to get them to see that you don't want to build with Corinthian wisdom of power struggles and boasting and personality cults and liking the people who have a better rhetorical skills, because if you're building on that kind of fluff, that's going to burn. That's not eternal wisdom of God. It's the kind of wood, hay, and straw that in the end is going to be shown to be not the eternal wisdom of God, but instead just mere human wisdom. So he's inviting them to reevaluate and to rethink why they've chosen their own personality cult in the first place, and he's really severely warning anyone who's ministering to make sure that they build with very great care. All because not only is the servant working God's field as God grows, not only is the servant building Christ's building, building on the foundation of Christ, but this is holy work. We're building a temple. There's a certain sanctifying of God's temple that should be expected of work that's done in the church. And that's why you come to this last paragraph, verse 16. This building project is important because we're not just building any building, we're building a temple. Now for Paul, who was a devout Jew, there was no more sacred place for him to think about than the temple in Jerusalem, where the people of God would gather together and to know that this is where God's presence resided fully. This is where God's holiness was most profound. This is where they needed to exercise the greatest care and approach, where only one high priest once a year could go, because it was a holy, holy, holy place. What's amazing is Paul takes all that away from the Jerusalem temple and says, you know what? The temple is now the people of God. It's not a building of brick and stone. It is the very building, the field, this temple that God's building, which is the people of God. And that building is holy. What you're building into people's lives as you grow a church is something you can't take lightly, because this is a holy task. So he says, verse 16, "Do you not know that you're God's temple and that God's Spirit dwells in you? And if anyone destroys God's temple," this is not light language, "God will destroy that person. For God's temple is holy, and you are that temple." He's trying to put a little tangle in all of his listeners, for them to recognize when they fight over who's most important and one person's better and this personality cult is more important, or boast in different leaders, they are destroying the temple. They are taking an agenda and putting it in place of the gospel. They are taking a personality and making that most important, and in doing that, they are playing with fire, turning the temple into a playground for their own spiritual vanity. And Paul solemnly warns, these things cannot be, because God takes this building project seriously, and those committed to building it must understand that the goal is to build it up, not to tear it down. The goal is for it to be a holy place where God's Spirit resides, not a place where the world's spirit consumes it with boasting and pride and ego and other such things. And it's at this point that he then returns to his eternal wisdom theme that he's been harping on for the last two chapters, and he just lets the rubber hit the road. Verse 18, "Do not deceive yourselves. If you think that you're wise in this age, you should become fools so that you may become wise. For the wisdom of this world is foolishness of God, for it is written," and then he quotes from both Job and Psalms, "He catches the wise in their craftiness, and again, the Lord knows the thoughts of the wise, that they are futile. So," verse 21, "let no one boast about human leaders." Boasting about human leaders as the most important thing for building God's temple is a flimsy house of straw. It will be burned. It won't last. And so he says, don't be deceived, Corinthians. This is not the way to go. You are turning the temple into a playground. You are not taking this task seriously enough. You've elevated certain leaders to a point where human wisdom is winning the day. You instead need to understand they are simply servants. They are simply servants assigned a very serious task of growing with God, of building on the foundation of Christ, and of making sure that God's people is a place where God's holiness, God's Spirit, God's wisdom is displayed and experienced. Paul doesn't even want himself to be included in this boasting. Verse 21, let no one boast about human leaders. Keep in mind, some were saying, I'm of Paul, I'm of Apollos. So N.T. Wright has this wonderful statement in his commentary. He says, Paul is just as cross about people putting him on a pedestal as he is about anyone else being there. There is only one pedestal in the kingdom of God and only one person to be put on it, but it isn't a statue to be put up as a monument, it is a cross. And the Messiah who hung and died on it passed judgment on all human fame, celebrity, popularity, and reputation. Paul just understands that boasting in human leaders is not the way you build the church. Those are serious words. They're challenging words. They're challenging in so many ways. They're challenging for anyone involved in leadership. They're challenging for all of us who are following certain leadership. But Paul doesn't end it with that downer. Because, you know, he's really just said as clearly as he could what he could have said right from the beginning. Let no one boast in human leaders. You're of Paul, you're of Apollos, you're of Cephas. Guys, quit doing that. I mean, he could have made it that simple. But he's gone on this elaborate way so that he can show us how the wisdom of God is so much better than the world's wisdom. And that's why these last two sentences are so interesting. The only way to understand them is to understand that the philosophers of Paul's day had different sayings that you could paraphrase in one way. They essentially said something like, if you have wisdom, you have everything. If you don't have wisdom, you have nothing. You know, Seneca, Aristotle, Plato, all of those will say things like that, that wisdom is most important, and if you have it, you have everything. Paul's going to take that sentiment and now apply God's wisdom to it and expand it to even more than anything you could imagine. So he says, verse 21, don't boast in human leaders, for all things are yours, whether Paul or Apollos or Cephas or the world or life or death or the present or the future, all belong to you. In other words, Corinthians, you're selling yourself short. You're selling yourself to one leader. I'm telling you, they're all yours. And not just all the leaders, the world and everything. It's all yours. Just keep in mind this, verse 23, you belong to Christ, and Christ belongs to God. Everything belongs to you except Christ and God. You belong to them. And because you belong to them, you have in your possession all of these rich resources that God has given. Don't sell yourself short, but understand in the end that God is the one who's sovereign. God is the one that brings the growth. God is the one that this building's all about. And God is the one that is to be at the focus of this temple that is being erected. And so you have Paul's beautiful way of ending this. Next week when we move into chapter 4 and we'll go all the way through chapter 4 and be done finally with this first controversy, you'll notice he's going to continue on talking about how you think of Christian ministers. That first paragraph is been incredibly important for 26 years for me. Think of us in this way as servants of Christ and stewards of God's mysteries. And he'll say some other things that are very important to keep sanity in ministry. So we'll be looking at that next week. But having covered all the way to chapter 3, I want to share three quick reflections that arise out of this text that's before us. Hopefully they'll have some relevance to our own ministries today. The first one is turf battles. Our staff will often talk in staff meetings, particularly when we have everyone present, about turf battles, about building silos. You know, everyone's got their own thing. You got Christian Edge, you got choir, you got the bulletin, you've got the circle of friends, you've got India, you've got budget, you've got building stuff, all kinds of things. And it's very easy to think, you know, here's what the church is about, my turf, my silo, what I'm building. And what you find out here, according to what Paul says, it's all yours. To be concerned about just one tiny bit and not the whole field is to miss out on all our working together with God and all our working for God. So that there should be an equal concern, or at least a diligent concern, to include everything when we're talking about a community life like ours. We're thinking about not just Christian ed, but jam time and confirmation and youth and on you could go. That instead of thinking them as silos that someone is over, that we're all in this together. We're all trying to build a building. We're all trying to make a holy place. We're all trying to grow the fruit of the Spirit in the lives of the people of God. All of them are ours. Our responsibilities, and all of them are important. So it seems to me Paul at least makes it clear that there's no place for turf wars or rivalry among the workers of God, because at the end of the day, the church isn't yours. It's not mine. It's God's. It's just not. This isn't Rich's church. I hate when people say that. It's not. It's Christ's church. It's God's church. This isn't Rich's ministry. It's God's ministry. I'm doing my best not to throw out as much wood and stay and straw and hay as I can, because believe me, that comes out voluminously. I'm happy to throw out wood and straw. It's so much harder to think about what's precious, what matters, what really is going to build on the foundation. How can I make it so ministry is not an instrument to advance my career or to advance my agenda, but to advance the cause of Christ? And I think serious hurt has been done to the Church of Christ by ministers who are there to advance either their career or their agenda, and not the cause of Christ. So turf battles and the warning against them, I think, is very clear here in chapter 3. And one of the reasons why these turf battles are so bad is at the end of the day, Paul will only allow one foundation. I mean, verse 11, is pretty clear. No one can lay any foundation other than the one that has been laid. That foundation is Jesus Christ. So that you have a foundation. That foundation is Jesus. And if that's the foundation, everything's to be built on it. And the challenge is, what building materials are we going to use to build wisely on that foundation? You got to build something on it, because you just can't stick with the foundation. If you think about Paul's metaphor and you take it to its furthest extreme, none of us live on just a foundation. We live in a building with walls and roofs and doors and structures and all of that. And the whole idea of a building is you're supposed to build something on it. You don't just, you know, sit there and stare at the foundation. You keep in mind that it's all there because of the foundation. That's what's keeping it stable. But at the end of the day, you're supposed to be doing something with it. You're supposed to be cultivating something and building something. And it seems to me Paul invites us to serious consideration of what we're building and why we're building it. N.T. Wright again has a wonderful comment. He says, it is possible to build wisely, well, and with the right materials. It is also possible to build badly or with the wrong materials. It is possible actually to pull down the building altogether. Paul talks about destroying the temple of God. God takes these possibilities very seriously, do we? That's one of the greatest efforts in any church's ministry, is to think, what are we building and why? Is it really built on the foundation? Is it gold, silver, and precious jewels? Or is it just some wood, hay, and straw? My guess is, if Chris's insight has any kind of weight to it, and it might, there's probably a place for some wood, hay, and straw, I guess. You know, not everything can be gold, silver, precious jewels. Then you kind of look like you're living in a billionaire's house. I mean, it'd be kind of weird. But at the end of the day, the point seems to me that we're to think about building lasting things, things that will stand, things that truly are firmly rooted in that foundation of Christ. Which leads to the last reflection, and it is just a wonder for me that Paul chooses these three metaphors of a field and building and temple, because what's beautiful about all those metaphors for the church is they all convey that the church is always a work in progress, that it's always under construction in some ways. You know, a field needs tending. You got to tend to it. You got to do something with that field. A temple needs those who are going to serve in it and do liturgy in it and elevate worship in it and bring some sense of the seriousness of the task to hand. And then, of course, a foundation makes it very clear to us that it's a work in progress. We're supposed to be building walls and building roofs and adding to this, adding some flooring, adding some decor, doing something with the building that builds on top of the foundation that we've been given. I guess for me, knowing that the church is a work in progress makes me at least wipe my brow occasionally and say, okay, you know, we're still rethinking, we're always kind of reforming, we're always evaluating. That's what we have to do to think about, are these precious materials, are we actually working in the field together? Is anyone getting too much credit or too much attention? Is there a silo that's being built in the midst of the field that perhaps needs to be torn down so there's more equality? What's going on and how do we keep all this going? Because at the end of the day, that beautiful picture of a temple makes me think that the church, at its best, should be a place where the Spirit dwells. And the Spirit is always the Spirit of love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, gentleness, faithfulness, self-control. The Spirit always brings that sense of Christ and the sense of acceptance and the sense of grace and the sense of welcome. All those things that the church is meant to be. And when it is that holy community, not walking in the wisdom of the world, but walking in God's wisdom, then it can actually be that sacred place wherein God's people are formed in Christ so that what is built might last. Would you pray with me?